Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Philosophy in Action. I'm Greg Perkins, here with philosopher Dr. Diana Shea, where we answer your questions, applying rational principles to the challenges of real life. For those listening to the podcast, please join us live, where there's a text chat to chime in with your follow-up questions and witty comments. The show airs Sunday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Mountain, 10 a.m. Central, and 11 a.m. Eastern Time at philosophyinaction.com. At the site, you can also submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows and browse the archives from past shows. Now, with all of that out of the way, let's jump over to the star of the show, Dr. Diana Shea. Okay, happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday, Greg. Tell us what is on tap this week.
All right, we have a great set of questions on confidence in opinions, delegation in marriage, deriving self-esteem from university study, and more.
Yeah, it should be a good set of questions here. Greg, by the way, I am getting a bad echo from you, so hopefully that'll clear itself up, or sadly, you can mute. Folks, if you're listening live, you can post questions and comments in the text chat that's over at philosophyinaction.com/live.
Yeah, unfortunately, the chat's not letting me in, but hopefully others. And so what's been going on?
So folks know, I had that horrible migraine. Again, Greg, the echo. Sorry. Really terrible. So I had that horrible migraine last weekend, and then I got another one on Wednesday. So like, ooh, and these are both basically 5-year migraines. In other words, they're the kinds of migraines that I get once every 5 years, and I got them in 4 days, two of them in 4 days of each other. So that was really horrible. I've changed some meds that I was on that I think were causing them. And so hopefully that's the end of that. Anyway, so that's basically been my week was recovering from those and preparing for the show. And actually, as I was just telling Greg before, while we were waiting for the show to start, doing this crazy deep clean of my kitchen, which is requiring hours and hours and hours to do, but is very necessary. So it's good to be getting the home in further order here.
Well, excellent. Hopefully Skype will stop doing the echo thing. That would be nice.
Freaking nice, Skype.
All right. If nothing else, we can move on.
Yeah, let's move on.
Confidence in opinions. How much confidence should a person express in her own opinions? I work with a woman who constantly makes declarative statements about things for which she lacks sufficient facts and knowledge. The result is that she is often contradicted, and people have to tell her that's not true. We will argue with them, and she will argue with them, and then they will have to prove her wrong so that the conversation can move forward. By contrast, I notice that I often express uncertainty in ways that undermine confidence in my knowledge and experience. The default position I tend to take is that maybe I'm missing something, and the other people in the conversation can give me that information. How does one learn to strike the right balance between being open to new facts and information, but also being confident in one's own knowledge and experience?
So, you know, I didn't think that this was a big problem when I first read the question. I thought, oh, you know, this is a sort of narrow, you know, narrow topic, blah, blah, blah. But then in the production meetings that I had both with you and Tammy, Greg, and then also with, I know I had that with Arthur. I can't remember if Andrew was in on this because this was 2 weeks ago. I think he was. But basically, we found so many examples. All of us had lots and lots of examples of people like this in our lives that are infuriating, and just like, it's like hitting a brick wall. And what can you do about these people who are just absolutely certain and dead wrong? And in a way, like, they don't care that they're dead wrong. They're not going to apologize. They're not going to be, oh God, I'm so sorry that I was like really committed to this view that's completely wrong afterwards. They never learn their lesson. And it's so frustrating. Right. So I thought that was interesting that
and they're not mortified that
right.
They were certain when they should not have been certain.
Right.
That's scary.
Yeah.
That's dangerous. I mean, okay. Anyway, we'll get into that.
Yeah. So we found that this was there was a lot more of this than I would have thought initially. And what I think is going on here is it's not really about the problem with this kind of person is not really about they're overconfident. That can be a problem, but it's not this problem. And so there's different strategies for addressing that versus just overconfidence, underconfidence, that kind of thing. So that's what we're going to talk about here today.
Excellent. Okay, so how can a person ensure that he expresses sufficient but not too much confidence in an opinion, in his opinions?
Yeah, like I want to start off with, like, here's the rational approach. I think that'll help set the context for dealing with the people who are, let's say, not so rational. So first of all, the primary thing that you need to ensure is that your confidence in your opinions is justified by the facts. That it's not, you're not just taking confidence as a matter of, well, I have a feeling or I'm making assumptions. So you need to be monitoring yourself. How actually certain are you of this opinion? And to answer that question, you need to say, well, you need to be able to specify, like, what's my evidence here? What are all our alternative explanations for this evidence? How is it that I've ruled them out? You know, have I even seriously considered them or not? Sometimes there's things that are default assumptions, and sometimes there are known truths, right? Sometimes there's things that are universal truths, and sometimes there's things that's just like, hey, look, this is how I am. This is personal experience. So you need to make sure to be differentiating between those kinds of things, and particularly not confusing the way that you are with the way that everybody is. Also here, I think it's really important to know your own failure mode. Do you tend to be overconfident or underconfident? And when, like under what circumstances, in what domains, you know, in what kind of social context, that kind of thing. So these are all, like, this is a kind of know thyself, know thy epistemic bases kind of important foundational issue here. So the second thing is then you should be accurately expressing your level of confidence when you are conveying this opinion to others. And I don't just mean in terms of the exact words you use, although that's important, but in terms of the fervor, the vehemence with which you say something, all of that body language and tone kind of issues. So don't feign more or less certainty than you have. Don't oversell or undersell your ideas here. And again, the language issue is important. And I think this is one way in which people tend to they tend to err, particularly, let's say, people who are more people-oriented or women tend to undersell themselves. Other people tend to perhaps oversell their ideas. So basically, make note of that. Monitor your language to make sure that it reflects your inner confidence level. And notice here that this kind of honesty with others, or this kind of integrity in conveying your opinions to others, is only possible if you are sufficiently self-aware. In other words, if you have the first point down, so that you know your own confidence level and you know whether and how your opinions are justified.
Yeah. So your goal is to be objective here. And then you want to be really clear about your level of certainty with yourself and others. So like in my case, I want to have the reputation of, no, when Greg acts like he's certain, he really does have a good basis. He thinks he's got it solid. And if he doesn't, if he's not certain, he will say that. He'll signal it. It's like, yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Yep.
Or maybe, oh no.
Yeah.
Here's what I try to think.
I could be wrong, right? That, yeah. You know, those kinds of phrasing should tell you something. And if you're absolutely certain, you shouldn't be using that kind of phrasing.
Yeah. So, yeah. And that's what's distressing when somebody has no basis for coming in hard, like, oh no, this is totally the thing to do. And it's like, oh, okay, you must have some basis for that.
Right.
A few false alarms like that. And it's like, no, that person isn't monitoring their
right.
Their objectivity. So
right.
It's just not
that's
a good
problem.
Signal.
Yeah. And it's also a problem when people undersell themselves too, because sometimes I'm really, like, I'm making a guess, or I'm going based on assumption. And if the people around me who know much more than me, if they know the actual facts, and they don't step up and say, hey, Diana, look, I know the actual facts here. This is, you've got it wrong. Here's the truth. Then I'm going to be making mistakes, and that's going to suck too. So it's important to note that both underselling and overselling your ideas have bad consequences for other people. So take note of that. Be kind to other people and honestly represent your confidence level.
Yeah. That- Super frustrating.
Greg, you actually just cut out, so we didn't hear any of that.
Well, that's frustrating. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Okay. So I was just reiterating the point that that's super frustrating when uh, I I don't know for sure, and I'm hunting around. We need a solution to move forward. And you're sounding the same. So it's like, okay, I guess we're going to have to maybe guess or flip a coin here. And in fact, you actually knew. And that's not good.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, I will say, if your goal is to be objective, if you're focused on the facts, then I do think that a tendency to be overconfident or underconfident will correct itself with time. Right? Because you will get feedback from reality and you will adjust your, you know, your sort of confidence meter up or down in general. You will notice contexts in which, oh, this is where I tend to be underconfident, this is where I tend to be overconfident, et cetera, et cetera. The danger when people don't correct themselves, that happens when they have some other agenda, when they're not focused on facts, when they're not concerned to be objective. Basically, oftentimes I think this is when they get their ego invested in particular answers, or when they're people pleasing. And I, you know, it's hard to talk about this. I wish I had some other language to talk about when people get their ego invested in this, because that is the way we tend to describe it. And I don't think it's quite right. And yet that's what it is. It's like they get personally invested in their particular answer that they already have in their brain. And so It's a failure of objectivity. It's a failure of egoism. Right? Egoism requires rationality. It's a failure of rationality. But I don't know quite how to describe this in a way that doesn't make it sound like, well, the problem is you need to be detached. The problem is you need to not care about things. Or the problem is you're too selfish.
Caring about the wrong thing.
It's
because they want to play. They think that what's important is maybe a social game where, oh, I'm the one in charge. I'm getting to make the decision. And they think it's more important to maybe be the one with the forceful personality who is the leader rather than actually having the correct solution.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do think that oftentimes there's people who do this in big ways, people pleasing and investing their ego in particular answers. And those are serious problems. But I think all of us, you know, like, unless you really straightened yourself out, all of us tend to do this at least a little bit. We tend to do one or the other, maybe. So that kind of, you know, mild bias, not a hideous moral crime. It's okay. If you see this in yourself, recognize it and say, okay, this is something I need to watch out for. This is me being objective, is noticing, let's say, that I tend to people please. And so I don't speak up when I should. I don't like to contradict people. That feels awkward to me. And so I'm going to have to push myself a little bit more to correct that problem so that I am more, I have more integrity, more honesty about reporting my confidence levels.
Or the opposite way where it's like, oh, I like to be right.
I do.
I like to win.
Yeah.
But I
think I tend to do both, right? So, you know, I need to notice that whenever my impulse is not fact-oriented, I need to notice that and say, okay, take a step back, Diana. Let's look at the facts. It's not just that people are one or the other.
And it really helps to, for me, it's helped to seriously internalize the need to have a fact orientation. If I want to navigate reality well and stay in it, then I can't be ignoring what I do know or making up certainty. That's why now I've kind of reached the point where I really am mortified. If I was certain of something and I got it really wrong, it's like, whoa, what did I mess up?
Yeah. Oh, I'm mortified too.
And then it mortifies me when someone else isn't mortified when they are over and over. They're super certain and like, hey, that's dangerous.
That'd be a fun topic to talk about at some point. It's like when you're embarrassed for other people because they themselves are not embarrassed and you're like, oh, only you.
Yeah.
Just how embarrassing.
Like they're the black knights. It's like, yeah, it's only a flesh wound. It's okay. It's like, what? Your arm is off. Come on. that was hideous.
Yeah.
They put others in danger. We have a case of somebody who we've done summit scrambling with and things like that. And really poor judgment, lots of certainty when it wasn't warranted. And it was actually dangerous. People could have gotten hurt or killed. And it's like, oh, okay, you're no. that's right out.
yeah, not again. Never again. Yeah. So just to review, the first point is to make sure that your confidence in your opinions is justified by the facts and that you know in fact what your rational confidence is. Second point is to be reporting that accurately, expressing that accurately to other people. The third point is to make sure that you don't ever close yourself off from correction and refinement. So notice when your opinions are challenged by new facts or new analysis. And also, though, notice when they're confirmed, particularly if you're somebody who tends to undersell us, you tend to diminish your knowledge. No, that's not quite the right phrasing. If you tend to underestimate your own knowledge or your own expertise, make sure that you know, oh, here's another piece of confirmatory evidence. Right? Make sure you take note of that.
Yeah. All right. So turning back to the coworker in the question, what do you think?
Yeah.
This is not that person's problem.
No, this is, yeah, this like being objective. I mean, like all of these things, this is not what that coworker is doing. And it's important to note, she is not merely expressing unwarranted opinions. That's again, this is not really her problem. She's doing something more. She's digging in her heels. She's derailing conversations. She's refusing to give up. She's wasting everybody's time. And in a way, at least from the description here, it seems like she's kind of putting on a show. Like maybe she is using these arguments to feel important or to control people. And that's why she's not mortified when she's wrong again and again and again. And so
yeah,
because she's actually,
control.
She's achieving her ends by doing what she is doing, right? The problem is those ends are irrational. So again, this is not a problem of overconfidence, although I think that's the way it's typically analyzed, and I think that's wrong. I think it's a problem of false confidence. It's a problem of an irrational agenda. In other words, that she's not fundamentally concerned with. And so we can ask, like, well, so what, what do we do about her? And I don't know that there's a ton that you can do directly. Like, for one, I think you should escalate the problem to your manager and or her manager. And
yeah,
Greg, you've worked in the corporate world more, you can say.
Yeah, this is exactly what managers are for. Let them do their job. Just say, hey, look, we're getting a lot of inefficiency from this little dance or whatever is going on. Can you please talk to her manager and help her learn some skills to not derail our work like this?
Right, right. I think in the absence of help from your manager, the only thing that you can really do is just refuse to have these arguments with her. You can just move the conversation forward. And here you might need to enlist the help of your coworkers. You know, let's say you're going to have a meeting where she's in it. You might enlist, say, one or two people, like, look, if this happens, let's not go there. Let's not argue. Let's just instead say something like, look, we can look that up later. We just don't have time right now. We want to get this. We're on a clock. We need to get this meeting done. I think that's particularly critical to do when her disagreements are of a personal nature or they're not mission critical. Like basically, where it's not some key point about your work that she's missing, but it's just some argument that she's generating. So I think that's the only thing you can do is basically refuse to engage in this dance with her. That's your only power.
Yeah, it's fantastic if you can do that. But all too often, I've seen people in the middle of a meeting where they're arguing about the actual substance of the meeting, and it's like, oh, okay, we have to do this.
Right.
This is and it's really wasteful.
Right. And that, you know, again, that's the job of the manager to help do that. I don't know. And maybe there's other things that you can do about sending out emails beforehand or those kinds of things, but ultimately, it's a behavioral problem. That's what managers are for. Yeah.
Indeed.
And I mean, I just think in general, this is the problem. In general, these people are not correctable. Like you cannot have a conversation with them about this and expect that to go anywhere. And I had this experience with somebody who I already knew this about the person. And last winter, I'm in the backseat of a truck. Another person is driving, and this person who's the particular problem is a passenger in this truck. And we're trying to get back home. And the passenger, again, this is the problem person, she's on the phone, so she's distracted, which makes things worse. And she's giving wrong directions, which are leading us like winding through this neighborhood. And the directions that she ultimately gave had us going around three sides of squares twice, not once, but twice. And I'm
and
in the
she's insisting
seat.
On the wrong directions,
yes,
right?
She's insisting because I'm in the back seat looking at my Google map, right? Looking at the little blue dot as to where we're going. And I'm saying, look, all we have to do is turn left and then turn right, and we will be right on the street that we need to be at. But instead we go like an extra 10 minutes winding through this neighborhood. And so I'm getting a bit more insistent because damn it, like I want to get home. I'm tired. Like this is ridiculous, right? I know exactly where we need to go. And apparently I pressed a little bit too hard because she yelled at me at one point, "I don't care what your map says." I was just like I was
so
just like,
one of us has, you know, the actual goods here. Why don't we use the goods?
So she had some other goal. I was so angry. I was so like, A, treating somebody that way, even if they're in the wrong, is horrible. Right. But particularly when I was in the right, it was even more infuriating. And the driver ended up following her directions. And, you know, so we went around these three sides of the square and blah, blah, blah. And I just like, I had to swallow it because I knew she would never apologize for it. Certainly not spontaneously. And if I went to talk to her about it, she just would have gotten extremely defensive, and she probably would have been nasty and unpleasant to me for weeks and weeks thereafter. And I was just like, I know it's not worth it. It's just not. Like, I just have to suck it up. The only thing I did do is I sent a Google map showing our actual route to the person who was driving, because I was so freaking mad. I at least needed her to know that how, like, just how wrong those directions were. But, like, with people who are so concerned to protect their ego in this way, where their ego is so fragile that they have to have the right answer, the answer that pops into their head has to be the right one, and they can't possibly countenance that they might be wrong. The likelihood that you're going to be able to sit down and have an honest conversation, honest and kind and productive conversation with them, and say, "Hey, look, this is a, you know, like, this is a problem. Can we find some better way of dealing with this?" That runs into their fundamental problem, because they're not willing to admit that they're wrong in the first place. And so,
yeah,
the only thing you can do is just keep your distance. And hope that maybe they get into therapy or whatever it is that they need to do so that they can improve themselves and so on. Because you're not going to do it. Like, this is a fundamental divide in terms of people that I'm willing to deal with and people that I'm not. There are people in the world who are, like, they make mistakes, and sometimes big ones, but they're working at getting it right. And they want to get it right. And you can go to them and have a conversation and say, "Hey, I think you got it wrong in this case. Can we talk about this? Can we find a better way of doing this?" And they'll say, "Yeah, like, that's important to me. I want to get this right. I'm like, I'm sorry I hurt you. I didn't mean to do that. Let's work out some better way in the future." And then they'll actually work to implement that. I will take people like that who are struggling, even if they're making mistakes and doing wrong and so on, over somebody who is generally better, but is not concerned to get it right, is not concerned they hurt you, is not concerned to improve themselves. And so there's this real fundamental divide in people between this. And I just, more and more, I cannot have any contact with the latter people. It is just not worth it. It's not worth putting up with them. So
yeah, there could be some character thing, but there's also, it could also be that some of this is so troublesome because of a Dunning-Kruger kind of effect, where their very lack of objectivity makes it so they can't see the difference between what they're doing and what other people who are more objective are doing.
Right.
They just can't, they can't perceive the problem. They're like, "Well, you are forceful and you win the conversation sometimes, and also I'm doing the same thing. I'm just being forceful too." And it's like, okay, yeah.
Yeah. More often, anyway, though, they see when you are forceful as you being you're bullying them. Like, they have this view about what happened. So it's like, it's this battle, it's this contest. And so, yeah, it's bad.
When it's like just some weird, some weird scene playing in their head, and it's like, "No, that's not what we were doing."
Right. And this is because, like, the facts are not in their head, right? It's all about this contest of wills. And the facts of the matter are they're not seeing them. They're not concerned with them. And that, like, you cannot do anything about those people. All you can do is add distance.
Yep. So, all right. Then, can expressing lots of confidence be a problem, even for a person who is committed to the facts? Could that shut down, say, non-assertive people?
Yeah, we had this discussion in our in the production meeting, and I thought this was interesting, just because you want to make sure that even if you're super duper confident, that you're not running people over in the process. And I do think that personality differences are relevant here. So, and as a general rule, I think if you're somebody who's very assertive by nature, if you are then very extra assertive in expressing your own views because you're very, very confident in them, even justifiably so, that can shut other people down. And so even when you're very, very confident, I think it's important to express that tactfully, to still invite the opinions and questions of others. So you can say things like, well, look, I'd like to tell you my view, and then I really want to hear yours. Or I really want to hear if you have any questions or concerns about this. This is really important that I hear these. I want to make sure that we've got this right. Right. So in other words, express your concern for getting things right, not just being the one whose view wins out in the end. And I think go ahead, Greg.
Oh, sorry. I was going to jump in and say that I live this one because Tammy and I are very much the opposite in this way, where I have to be very careful to say, okay, I'm trying to find the right answer here, be really clear about what I know and don't know, and try not to just run her over, because if I act really confident, she has the sort of personality that is like, okay, you're confident, we're going to go do this. And I'm like, okay, but do you have any evidence that I might have made a mistake here?
Right. You know, like you're a smart person. I want to hear your views.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I think in that case, if you do that, if you invite other people's views, if you're tactful about it, then it is the obligation of those other people, even if they're not assertive by nature, to speak up if they want to be heard, right? If they remain silent, if you have solicited their opinion, if you have given room for their opinion and they remain silent, that's on them. So the obligation of the assertive person is to be tactful, and the obligation of the non-assertive person is to speak up.
Grow a pair, Ryan. Let's do this.
Yeah, everybody doing their part there, assertive and non-assertive people.
Indeed. So, all right. Know what you know and also know your failure modes. Okay, what's the take-home point?
So the problem with your coworker here is not overconfidence, but a lack of concern for the facts and some other agenda. That's the key to actually not being underconfident or overconfident, is to focus on the facts, including the evidence that justifies your beliefs, and then accurately conveying that to others.
Indeed. Not seeing any real follow-up here, so it's time for the reminder about the tip jar.
So Philosophy in Action Radio, not just the live show, but the podcast too, is available to anyone free of charge. That's because we want to spread rational principles far and wide. We do that with every show to thousands of listeners, but we can't accomplish that alone. We do rely on the support of our fans. So if you value our work, please do contribute to our tip jar. You can visit philosophyinaction.com/support to send money online or via the mail. We suggest $5 per episode or $20 per month, but any amount is welcome. And you can also create a recurring monthly tip via PayPal, Dwolla, or your bank's bill pay. Then you don't need to remember. You also get free access to Philosophy in Action's premium content, and we really appreciate that regular support. Again, you can do that all at philosophyinaction.com/support.
Delegation in marriage. When is delegation in a marriage irresponsible or unwise? There are some parts of normal adult life that I'm really bad at, in part due to social anxiety. Examples include calling or meeting with companies, airlines, banks, and so on, to make changes, writing emails that involve stress or conflict, scheduling events that we'll both attend, budgeting and finance, driving and navigating, and dealing with mechanical stuff. Should I ask my husband to do those chores? If I ask for help, I worry that I'm being weak, lazy, and avoiding my responsibilities. On the other hand, if I try to do the hard things on my own, I often mess up. Where's the line between delegating and shirking?
So this is a really good and, I think, pretty interesting question. And it's not just relevant to marriage. It's also relevant to roommates, business partners, coworkers, and so on. It's relevant to any relationship in which you have a relationship of equals. So it's not a manager-direct relationship. And there's work to be divided. And the question is, well, like, how are we dividing up the work? By what principles are we going to divide up this work? And how much should each person play to their own strengths and allow others to cover for their weaknesses, versus how much do you want each person to push and stretch themselves to do things that are a little bit harder so that they cultivate their skills and confidence? And there's not a single answer here. A lot is going to depend on context. And so I guess that's how we're going to answer the question, is see what context really matters here. Greg?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, now I can hear you.
Dang it. Okay, so what are the some of the factors that we should be looking at?
Yeah, so first of all, first issue is the work being divided roughly fairly, right? Usually that means equally, but not always. You could have a business partner that's a 70-30 business partnership or something like that. So here in this case, the list of tasks that the questioner prefers not to do seems pretty long. And in some cases, asking the spouse to do them every time might impose a substantial burden on him, and that wouldn't be fair to him, right? So you need to make sure to take care. You might need to discuss this a lot. You might need to be constantly revisiting this and saying, okay, how much are you doing versus what I'm doing? And that's actually really, really important to figure out how the division of labor works. And it's not always, you can trade money for time. You know, if one spouse is earning more, the other spouse might do more. That's totally fine. It's not like, well, look, I don't care that you're earning all the household income. You need to get out there and mow the lawn. That's not always how those kinds of things work. That's not always what's fair. Anyway, so lots of discussion, particularly to make sure that one person doesn't feel more burdened than the other. So that's the first point, dividing the work fairly. Secondly, and this is where we start to get into the more interesting psychological stuff. Does your avoidance of certain tasks mean that you are not going to be competent in basic life skills? Okay, so it's no problem that you don't like budgeting and finance, but can you manage money if required? Are you involved in financial decision-making about joint finances? Right, so it's totally fine for your spouse to be the primary in this area, but you should at least be involved enough so that you know the basics, particularly so that you could manage the money if you need to. And I think this is really, really important. If you look at people who allow their basic life skills to atrophy in marriage, there's two really horrible things that happen as a result of that. First of all, many of them stay in god-awful marriages because they are deathly afraid to strike out on their own. They don't know how to manage money. They have no idea what money means. They have no idea like how to write a check. I mean, I know people who, when their spouse died, had not written a check in 25 years and didn't know how the banking system worked anymore. Right? That's a problem. The second thing that happens is that basically they make disastrous mistakes or they completely fall apart when their spouse is hurt in an accident or contracts a serious illness or dies because they have no idea what to do. They cannot take over those tasks. And that is so dangerous, right? Do not put yourself in a position where you don't know how to care for yourself or where you're not psychologically equipped to do so by depending on your spouse in a way that makes you incompetent. And this actually, now that I think about it, this happened with Paul and I once. When he used to come down and feed the horses with me all the time. And then he broke his hip. And so like he got out of the habit of doing that. And he didn't resume. And as a result of that, there was one point at which I had strep throat and I was really quite ill. And it would have been helpful even for him just to go down to the barn and throw some hay at the horses. But it didn't even occur to him, or he didn't propose it, because he just hadn't been doing that at all for like 2 or 3 years. I had been the only person feeding the horses. And we ended up having a conversation about it afterwards and saying, this is not cool. Like, you need to know how to do the basics here so that if I'm incapacitated or I'm sick, you can actually be helpful. And he, to his credit, he absolutely agreed with me. And then he started coming down with me and feeding the horses so that he knew the basics of what to do again. And that, like, I think that's really important. You need to be able to, if you're a spouse, you're running a household, you know, you've got kids, you've got animals, whatever, you just got stuff that you need to manage. You need to make sure that either person can be a pinch hitter for everything. I mean, maybe not the optional stuff, but the stuff, anything that matters, anything that's required for the household to keep running, you need to make sure that both people can do that. Comments on that, Greg?
Oh, no, I totally agree. It's just really dangerous if you lack the skills to be, you know, just to be able to get through normal operations, right, for a little while.
And yeah. I will say, like, so suppose your spouse changes the oil on the cars. That is not something that you need to know in case he gets incapacitated, because that you can go take the car in and get the oil changed.
Yeah,
right?
We have people for that down the street.
Yeah, and so there's things that, like, it's okay to, it's not that you need to know how to do everything personally or yourself, but you need to, like, if you can hire somebody to do this, you need to know how to hire somebody. You need to know how to get it done. That's the critical point.
Yeah.
okay. So that's the...
Know that it's needed and where you can get it. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the second point, which is really critical. Make sure that, that your division of labor is not making either of you incompetent in the basic skills and knowledge, the how-to knowledge of managing the household and your life. Third, what are your reasons for not wanting to do these tasks? I think there's a real big difference here between this task, it just isn't my strength. It's not what I find interesting. It's oh God, it's painful and unpleasant for me to do, versus I hate dealing with this whole area of life due to anxiety, right? It's totally fine to have strengths and weaknesses. Everybody does. It's fine to have preferences. Some people like routine more than other people. And Greg, you're going to talk about this in a minute. But I think it's a very different matter to allow anxiety to fester and grow by avoiding doing any of these anxiety-provoking tasks. If helping you avoid anxiety in that way becomes the job of your spouse, that's a disaster for you. It's a disaster for the marriage. It's very, very unhealthy. So in contrast, it's a positive good to leverage the strengths of each person in the marriage. So Greg, tell us your strategy for dividing work with Tammy.
Oh, yeah. We have different personalities, definitely different interests and strengths. And so we just try to find we divide up the work based on who has more interest or skill in that area so that we can get through the stuff that needs to be done with less friction. And
give us some examples.
Oh, well, you know, see, Tammy loves detail-oriented stuff and lists of tasks and all that kind of grind through it kind of thing. I go to sleep. I don't like that kind of thing at all. I like making decisions, though. If there's and that's where we've recognized each of our strengths. It's like if she were given lots of decision making, a steady stream of that, it would just drive her nuts, and she'd be jammed up. If she's given the list of things to worry about, though, she loves grinding through those. And I would be the opposite. I would be there's that long list, and I will
Poor
won't
dear.
Be working through it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'll be, you know, it would not be good. It would be the exact opposite problem. So instead, what we do is we try to make sure that if it's a big, important thing, that it really is in the hands of the person who can do it most easily and effectively. But we also recognize that we do need to develop those strengths, those skills that we were lacking in. So we look for opportunities to bolster our skills at the same time. So I don't do all the decision making. I throw sort of developmentally appropriate decisions her way, and she throws developmentally appropriate grind tasks my way.
Right. Right. Yes.
Yeah, so she rolls her eyes when I don't do stuff.
Everybody has to be stretched a little bit. Everybody needs some.
Yeah.
Everybody needs to do some of the things that maybe it doesn't float their boat, but it's good. It's good for them to be doing that sometimes.
And we try to be sensitive to when the other person's getting jammed up. I mean, she can watch me, you know, not doing stuff, and I can watch her getting stuck. And we try to prod each other with what's needed.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's
And
I think
it's
that
kind of
really
a continuous thing for me. It's like, okay, you have to choose this. It's a anxiety prone decision making time, T, and she'll be like, fine, it's good for me, and make the damn decision. Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay, so that's the third point is to differentiate between strengths and weaknesses versus issues about anxiety. The fourth issue is to tackle social anxiety directly whenever that impairs your ability to perform basic tasks required for your life and happiness. And so I have a few suggestions here. I'm sure there's lots and lots of resources on the internet, and I'm sure lots of these are not new to you, but they might be a helpful place to start here. First of all, take on smaller, well-defined tasks that develop your skills and your confidence. So it's probably not the case that you should be the person to refinance the house, but you could be involved in that decision-making process, and you can maybe be the one to call the mortgage company with questions. Like, you might hate it, but hey, that's good practice for you. If you're worried about screwing up, tell people that in advance. This is something I actually really like to do. I'll be like, I have no idea what I'm doing. Would you help me with this? And most of the time, people will then be extra nice, because somebody who's basically decent, somebody who doesn't completely hate their job, will really enjoy making a difference for somebody, of helping shepherd them through something. It makes them feel important. It makes them feel confident. So, you know, tell people, look, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't even know what to ask for here, but here's my situation. Can you help me? Right. And people will often really, really respond to that.
Yeah. And this is a favorite technique of mine. It's like, oh, there's lots of stuff I'm totally ignorant about. And so I tell them,
right,
I'm sorry, I don't know the protocol here, but please, here's my goal. How do we do it?
Right. And I remember actually it's people rarely respond badly to this. I had one case where I was looking for a venue for a SnowCon brunch, and it was unfortunate. It was like a Sunday morning, which is obviously a super busy day. And I called this one restaurant and asked whether they might have a room available. And I said it in this way, like, I know it's unlikely cause it's Sunday, but, you know, but I thought I would ask, blah, blah, blah. And her response was so contemptuous. Like, it was the manager, like, how dare you even ask this ridiculous thing? And I was just like, really?
Oh, that's unusual.
Really? Yeah. But that has stuck with me for years because that was so unusual. So like that does happen, and that's not your fault. That's like, that's on them. For one.
Sorry to inconvenience you. Is there somebody else that might want to be helpful?
Yeah. And unfortunately it's at a restaurant that I really like and it's their most convenient location. Cause otherwise, so I still go there, but otherwise I would have just never gone back to that restaurant just because, like, dude, that was so inappropriate. That was so rude for you to treat me as if I was, like, to treat me as if I should have known something that I had no way of knowing, and there was no harm in asking. Yeah. So again, ask for help.
KPOM does note that you should not do that with the used car salesman.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Or the guy at the poker table. And it's like, yeah.
Yeah. If you're trying to learn to play poker, that's not the right approach. Third suggestion here is to ask for help from your spouse. Not that he should do the task instead of you, but maybe he can help you develop a plan, right? If the task is within your wheelhouse, but you're a little bit stuck on it, say, hey, look, I need some help figuring out how to best do this. Or let's say if you're worried about making a mistake, maybe your spouse can check your work. He can read that email before you send it. He can help you figure out what's the three questions that you need answered in this phone call, that kind of thing. And that gets me to my fourth point, which is to write down talking points, particularly for phone calls. I think this is actually really important, at least for me. I've had social anxiety more so in the past, more so in my early 20s than now. And phone calls were the worst. They are just absolutely the worst. Like, emails are fine. Talking in person with people is okay, but phone calls are horrible. And so if I went into a phone call without a plan, I was just going to be stammering and stuttering and not able to get out what I wanted. But if I went in there saying, like, I would even have bullet points of, like, here's the things I'm going to say, right? Like, here's my name and I have this question and then I have this other question and what about this, right?
That's funny. So we're laughing because this is actually a favored technique of ours.
Yep.
It's really clarifying to say, okay, here are the essential things that have to happen during this call.
Yep.
And there's the talking points. Okay,
Tammy, don't you agree phone calls are the worst?
Oh, yeah. She's over there nodding, going, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, phone calls are the worst.
Very anxious.
Yeah. And so make a plan. And don't think, well, I should just be able to do this. Well, like, maybe you will be able to do this, but the way in which, I mean, A, you might always need the plan, and that's okay. Like, that's all right if you always need a plan before you make one of these difficult phone calls. But the way in which you end up not needing to make the plan is by making the plan again and again and again and getting lots of practice at it. And then, you know, you'll need less of a plan, or you won't need a plan for so many phone calls or whatever it is. So,
or less detailed plan.
Yeah.
So it starts out with whole sentences and paragraphs.
My name is Tammy Perkins, yeah. Or my name is...
way down to just bullet points with a word or two of, like, yeah, don't forget to ask about this area. And... That this is the normal kind of a growth plan where you give yourself those developmentally appropriate things and build up your strength, your resilience.
Absolutely. The other thing that I really recommend doing is if you feel like lost, you don't know what you're doing, is Google and try to figure out sort of what the lay of the land is. So let's say you are planning an event. You can do some Googling on event planning and good venues and questions to ask. And that'll help you figure out what kind of questions you need to ask when you call up for the venue.
Yeah, you would be amazed at, if you Google for how to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, you would find a nice set of instructions.
Yeah.
Anything. So So Google's your friend. Develop Google food. That's a skill to have.
Yeah. And I will say, I mentioned I had social anxiety, particularly, I mean, I had it badly, I'd say, in my early 20s. And so I remember when I was planning my wedding, I was 24, and like, I could not even get started. I was just completely paralyzed. And my mom came to visit. And so she helped me make phone calls and so on. And that, like, that got the ball rolling. That was really helpful. And then it's funny, though, because since then, I've done so much event planning that doing that wedding again, that would be nothing. Like, that would just be absolutely, absolutely nothing. But that doesn't mean that doing these kinds of things isn't still uncomfortable and awkward and icky for me, right?
It's just that you're good at it now.
Yeah, like, I can get through it. But it's important to recognize this. I remember having this conversation once with my friend at the time, Lynn Zinser, because she seemed so much less socially awkward than me. And she really knew how to talk to people. She knew how to make small talk that was interesting and get to know people and disagree with people in this friendly way. And I asked her, like, how do you do this? Like, it seems so easy for you. And she said to me, like, it's not easy. Like, I work at it, and I do feel awkward and uncomfortable, but I have certain strategies, and here's the strategies that I use. And I thought that was really a kind of revelation to me, that here this person that was doing this, what seemed to be very difficult to me, so easily, it was still a struggle for her. But what she did was use a bunch of skills so that it seemed much easier from the outside. And so just because other people, it seems easy to them, that's not always the case. And so it doesn't have to be easy. It doesn't have to be, you know, woohoo, this is the most fun or easy thing out there. It can still be difficult, and that's okay.
Indeed.
And so, yeah, so just work on, I think, developing the skills.
Yeah.
That's what's going to make
know your weaknesses.
Yeah.
Tammy,
easier.
Always under the impression that I was a super outgoing and gregarious and easy time with people, and was like, no, people are draining for me. I had to specifically train myself to have enough endurance to hang out with people.
Right.
I built some skills so I could cope with it.
Right. Yeah. So basically, I think you need to develop a growth mindset here. Don't allow yourself to be held hostage by anxiety. I think that's crippling to your self-esteem. It's crippling to your independence. It doesn't mean that you have to do all the things all the time, right? And that you need to do them all starting right now, but aim to become a better you. Aim to improve yourself, to push yourself in small ways again and again, and you will find that things that used to be very, very difficult or impossible become easier, become possible, become things that are in your wheelhouse.
Excellent. Okay, that sounded kind of take-home pointy, but maybe something broader. What's the take-home point?
Yeah, so I do think it's good to delegate in marriage based on your strengths and weaknesses, but I do think that's very, very different from one spouse enabling dependence and anxiety in the other. Instead, use your spouse's help to overcome these problems so that you are more competent at things that you need to do in life.
Indeed. There was an interesting comment that went by here from Richard. How about having an attitude of, I want it done right my way, so I'll do it myself. Maybe that's less than helpful, he's commenting. That's actually one of the things I've noticed is a failure pattern of mine.
Yeah. In marriage, I would actually suggest submitting that as a separate question about what's right or wrong about that attitude. I think particularly in marriage, if that results in, I think that what that often results in is you doing 80 or 90 or 95% of the things. And that is not workable. That is not good. That is not the way things should be. So,
yeah. And it can build resentments
and
encourage that weakness in the other person and all sorts of stuff like that. So it's not good.
Yeah.
And let's see, I'm not seeing anything else. So, let's move on. Deriving self-esteem from university study. Can a person derive any self-esteem or happiness from university study? Study is not a productive activity. It is preparation for future productivity. In light of this, how can I draw any self-esteem from my studies, whether successful or not? Can I consider my learning as productive achievement, even though I am not making any money from it or creating anything? Do I have to wait until later to start being happy or feeling self-esteem? Should I be working on the side while taking classes?
Oh dear. This is a
holy rationalist cats.
Yeah, holy rationalist Batman. Yeah. Now, I hope that the person who is asking this question is asking it because it seems like this might be the objectivist view, but it seems wrong in some way and he doesn't know how. So I hope that's what's going on. If so, that would be good because it is definitely a very, 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 very wrong view here in the question. And hey, even if this is your view, that's all right. We'll straighten you out. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. And let us count the ways. Why is this view so wrong?
We're only going to talk about three ways. First of all, a person cannot live without at least some self-esteem and some happiness. This is true even of small children. So let's think about what self-esteem and happiness mean here. Self-esteem means that you think yourself worthy of living and capable of living. Happiness means that you experience life as worth living, that it's a net positive for you. So just imagine trying to live. And this means not just like, being fed through a tube, but going out and exerting all the effort of discovering what you need to do to succeed in life and then going and doing all those difficult things. Imagine doing that without self-esteem and happiness, without feeling that you are worthy of living and capable of living and that life is worth living.
Gosh, that would be like doing some kind of a huge front-loaded investment with zero hope of winning.
Oh, it's horrible. It's horrible, right? People cannot live. They cannot survive without some self-esteem or happiness. They will, in fact, die. They will either actively kill themselves or just passively allow themselves to die without this. So basically, if a person couldn't experience happiness or cultivate self-esteem until that person started working and earning money, he'd never make it to that point. He would be dead long before. So this is a reason to check some premises here. Okay, so that's the first point. Self-esteem and happiness are required for life at all stages. Secondly, productive achievement is not the only source of self-esteem and happiness, particularly not productive achievement where you're earning money. Any effective pursuit of a life-serving goal, whether cooking a yummy dinner or learning to straight punch effectively, that's something I've been working on, performing a new piece of music well, or being present for a friend in distress, all of these kinds of things can and should be a source of self-esteem and happiness, right? Because by doing these activities, you are making your life and yourself better. You are cultivating the capacities required for a successful life as a human being. You are enhancing your life, right? And so that's why you can and should feel self-esteem and happiness as a result of doing them well. And that's why you can feel self-esteem even when you're five, because you are doing things that are successful, good endeavors for you. You are learning how to tie your shoelaces, and that is an important life skill to have. So, yeah. Productive achievement is not the only source of self-esteem and happiness. So thirdly, school is, yes, hopefully preparation for future productive achievement. So I think it's, in a way, it's not fundamentally different from an architect visiting the site, his building site, in preparation for building in while he's making his plans, right? It's just more long range. So you can think of it as, this is how I'm preparing myself for future achievement. And if it helps to think of it that way, then think of it that way. But that's not the fundamental point here at all. The fundamental point is that you don't need to be working and earning money in order to feel self-esteem and happiness about your activities. So Greg, you had a different approach to this question that I thought was fairly interesting.
Well, yeah, this is my self-development program of trying not to be rationalistic myself. So, looking around for evidence. You could actually look for the facts on the ground. Just ask yourself, have you ever derived happiness or self-esteem from study? I mean, you've been living your whole life. Well, it turns out, yeah, trillions of examples from learning to tie your shoes or doing well on a test. Your life has been filled with examples of you're feeling pretty good about achieving something. And so you should ask yourself, hey, if this idea I have that shouldn't be worth anything is being contradicted trillions of times, what's going on there? Am I making trillions of mistakes, or is maybe that idea maybe not right? So you can examine those facts and look for what's going on, and you probably would pretty quickly come to the conclusion that you're making an investment in yourself. You're developing the skills you need to live, and that's a very reasonable thing to be happy about.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And so then you should go back and look at, why, how did I make that mistake with that idea?
Right. Yeah, what's fundamentally gone wrong here?
Yeah.
Now, on this point of, Greg, I'm getting the echo again, sorry. On this point of, you know, look, have you ever actually felt these emotions from doing things that are not money earning? The questioner asked, do I have to wait until later to start being happy or feeling self-esteem? And I just want to mention, that's not how emotions work. You cannot control them in that way. It's natural, it's unavoidable even, to feel happiness and self-esteem if and when you succeed in school, provided that you value the work that you're doing, provided you recognize this is a connection to my success as a human person. And so that's good. So check some premises about how you think emotions work too here. I think that's part of the issue here.
Yeah, I just keep I keep packing it down, repressing, packing it down until it just explodes. And
yeah.
not so healthy. No.
I don't
okay. So a lot of good stuff to think about. What's the take-home point?
So you can and should derive self-esteem and happiness from university study and from every life-serving activity, even if not productive work. If that weren't the case, then a person wouldn't be able to survive to the point of starting work. Let me just mention one other thing. It might be that working a job is a really great thing for you to do while you're studying at the university. I worked through high school, I worked in college, and it actually was really important to me. It was important to me psychologically, it was important to me to have my own source of income, it was important to me to feel like I was a competent person who could support myself. And even if my, you know, philosophy degree didn't turn out to be all that great, like, hey, I knew how to wait tables and I could always do that. So it actually was important for me to be outside of the university working. And I always hated to work. Well, in fact, I never did work on campus jobs. Like, I wanted to get out of that university environment. I wanted to be out in the real world working. And that was important for my self-esteem and my happiness. But because it was an addition to university study, not because, well, I was getting no value or no self-esteem or happiness from university study. So by all means, go work. Like, I don't want to discourage somebody from working and working outside the university. I think that's really important. But make sure you're doing it for the right reasons.
Indeed. Okay. Any follow-up action? Not seeing a lot here. So time to move on. It's rapid fire question time, where we'll put Diana on the hot seat. I'll ask questions from this long and growing queue in any old order, and random stuff can happen because there's not a lot of preparation. So let's see what's interesting here. What do you think is the status of the death premise in America? Is hatred of the good for being the good a major force? What are some examples of that premise at work in modern America? I'm sorry, I don't use that language.
No, I don't either. I think there's some of that. There's some of that in America today. There's definitely this hatred of people who get too successful. They're too big. They're too successful. So, you know, we need to bring them down a peg, that kind of attitude. And I think that's bad.
Yeah, big is bad.
Yeah.
It's too big to fail, which is a weird little contradiction.
Right, or it's like, you know, in bed with the government is something else. But
yeah.
there's certainly been, you know, Apple used to be the underdog. And so, like, you know, like, bad Microsoft, go Apple. But now that Apple has, like, more cash than, I don't know, most nations, and they're huge and they're super successful, that suddenly there are people turning around saying we need to regulate them. They've got too much power. We need, like, antitrust actions against them. Even though there's no indication that they're screwing people over in any way, shape, or form. There's plenty of other alternatives if you don't want to do Apple products. So I think that is sort of hatred of the good for being the good. I think that's I wouldn't call it the death premise. I would save that more for the Islamists who are
really nihilistic.
Yeah. I don't know. And maybe this is me missing the whole point about Lestrade in a way, to not see all these tiny little manifestations of the death premise. But I don't think that people it doesn't function for them psychologically as a manifestation of the wish to die. Like they have other motivations. They have other, they're not conceptually clear, and they don't in a way realize the philosophical implications of what they're advocating. And I think it's really rare to find people who worship death, thankfully, or hate explicitly hate the good. Like they say, like, this is the good and I hate it because it's the good. That's really rare, thankfully.
Yeah. And let's see, maybe kind of one that's topical to wrap up here. It's not on the list yet, but I can see it just appearing now at the top. What do you think about this whole Donald Trump phenomenon?
Oh, God. I pay no attention to it whatsoever. I think it's a flash in the pan, for one. I think there's some interesting.
Is he tapping into something?
I haven't followed him enough because there's not a single person, a single Facebook friend of mine who has said a single nice thing about him. And so I'm just not in contact with people who are attempting to support him in any way, shape, or form. So thank goodness. So it just hasn't felt relevant to me in a personal way. And I just haven't encountered those arguments, but I think that there oftentimes is this sense of like, we just need something new. We need something different. There's a sense of disaffection, particularly from people who are ignorant and unprincipled and just conceptually, whoa, like who knows what's going on in their heads, right? And maybe he's tapping into that. And I think that on the one hand, that's going to die away and it's going to be replaced with standard Republican political operatives of various kinds.
Yeah.
Which is better in a way, right? Because he's truly awful. I mean, just like awful as a human person. Like, I mean, who would ever say the thing that he said about Megyn Kelly? I mean, are you freaking kidding me? Like the idea that this person could be the Republican presidential nominee and say those kinds of things, like, wow, yeah, but that's not going to happen because that's appalling to any decent person with half a brain.
Yeah, I wonder what if there's something that he's there's a couple of different factors. Maybe the one issue voters who hear him saying the right thing on that one issue could be happening, and then maybe also those who are just sick of the Republican leadership, the party apparatus, and they're like, okay, this is a bomb being thrown in.
Yeah, I don't know.
There's something going on.
It's so much worse than anything else that's out there. I do not like sometimes with things like this that I know they're not going to persist. It's just a kind of flash in the pan. I deliberately avoid really seeking out the news about it because I wish to preserve my benevolent view of humanity.
I thought the flash in the pan would be gone a long time ago. So now it's like, yeah, wow, it's really got some
legs. It's not going to last. There was recently a Facebook post that I saw just like, remember, you know, 4 years ago at this point in time, here were the major front runners in the Republican field. And it was a bunch of people who completely tanked. The person I am sad is tanking is Rand Paul. Not that I mean, based on his views on abortion, I'm like, I've got real problems with him. But he's got, apart from that, he's got a lot of really, really good views. And he's much better than so many other Republicans on so many issues. And even if he didn't get the nomination, I would like him to do well. I would like those ideas to be in play. And so that's disappointing.
Okay. All right. Need to move on. Because it's time for us to sign off from another episode of Philosophy in Action Radio. Thanks for listening. We hope you all had a great time.
I had a fantastic time once again. Thank you to our generous contributors. With every episode of Philosophy in Action Radio, we bring you ideas that engage the mind and help you live better. Plus, we introduce thousands of other listeners to the principles they need to live virtuous, happy, and free lives. We think that's hugely important, and we do depend on your support. So if you want to contribute, just go to philosophyinaction.com/support.
Remember, we welcome feedback on what we're doing well and what we could do better, too. Just email the feedback to diana@philosophyinaction.com.
If you want to see what's on tap for the next few weeks, visit philosophyinaction.com/upcoming. But I'm not broadcasting next week. God, Greg, sorry, did I not tell you this? I'm pretty sure I didn't tell you this.
That's a new one. Okay.
Sorry. No, I'm doing a little workshop in Atlanta with some friends, a self-improvement workshop. And so I will be occupied at the relevant time. So no broadcast.
All right, folks, get to sleep in.
Yeah. Well, particularly since I missed last week because of the migraine, I will see about finding an old lecture and posting a podcast for this week. I think that would be a good thing for me to do.
Excellent. I'm Greg Perkins, and you can find me online at objectivismseminar.com. The show features Dr. Diana Brickle, and you can read her blog, Noodle Food, at philosophyinaction.com/blog. Please drop by to submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows, and then join us live here at the same time next week at philosophyinaction.com.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.